to this afternoon. The case is Admanco versus 700 Stanton Drive. And welcome all here today, but particular welcome go to, I think, a couple of students. Marquette Law School students, are you here? And if so, would you stand and be recognized, please? Both of you, come on. And are you from Marquette Law School also? Then you have
professor.
I'm sorry. That's right. Thank you. You
and my former law clerk. That's
right. I remember now. Yes, indeed. Welcome and thank you for coming. Okay, let me introduce the court. You will see a couple of empty seats, and let me start with Justice Prosser. I'm Ann Walsh Bradley. One of the empty seats on the right is Justice Ziegler, and the other in the center here is Chief Justice Abrahamson, and neither of them will be participating in this case today. Next is Justice Crooks, Justice Rogenfack, and then Justice Gableman. So with that, by way of introduction, we will proceed. Counsel, you may take the podium, state your name, and proceed. Tell us everything you know about letters of credit.
No.
May it please the court. My name is Valerie Bailey Reen. At the heart of this case, it does involve a letter of credit and a holder of a letter of credit, their rights to draw on that letter of credit when the customer or the tenant is in default. In today's commercial transactions, letter of credit are very common and provide an important function. For instance, landlords that are building out commercial property usually incur a lot of upfront charges to build out a space for their tenant. The tenant then enters into a lease, and the landlord recoups those charges over the period of the lease. The same in this type of case where you're providing what's called a sale leaseback, where the landlord is actually giving the tenant money, buying the building, and then the tenant is leasing it back from the landlord. So they're providing a lot of cash out front. In connection with that, they're looking to a lease term of a longer period of time so that they can recoup their investment. And they also are looking for a letter of credit to also secure their obligations. Letters of credit are also used by cities, for example, if they're putting in new development. A new development is going in and the city's putting in the streets and the curb and gutter. The city will like a letter of credit in case the developer fails to put up the houses and the city doesn't get paid by the increased real estate property taxes. So they're very common. And the reason for that is the bank is in the business of lending. Banks understand credit. They understand risks. And so what they do is they will agree to issue a letter of credit for a fee because they have the underwriting, they have the experience with their customers so that they know whether or not the customer has the financial wherewithal and can assure payment. Another area that letter of credit are used in is the situation where you have a vendor, an out-of-state manufacturer, shipping goods into Wisconsin or international too. They're concerned about getting paid, so they request a standby letter of credit so that if their customer doesn't pay them, the bank will, and so that they're, again, guaranteed payment because landlords, vendors, cities, governmental entities, they're not in the business of providing financing. They want the assurance that they're going to get paid. And the arrangement benefits everybody. It reduces transaction costs. Instead of having to secure the obligation by some other way, by a security agreement that's filed, a UCC financing, mortgages, things of that nature, they get a letter of credit, the bank gets a fee, the bank already has an existing relationship, so it's already usually collateralized, has a UCC filing and or a mortgage. And that's what occurred here. 700 Stanton, my client, provided $2.8 million of cash to Admanco. In return for that, it took a 15-year lease and a $375,000 letter of credit from the Bumbies, which are the owners of Van Mankel, completely separate transactions, personal letter of credit issued on behalf of the Bumbies. It also took a letter of credit from Ed Mankel for the same amount, $375,000. M&I issued both letters of credit. About 9 months later, Ed Mankel filed for receivership and failed to make a monthly lease payment. When it did that, 700 Stanton provided it with notice and an opportunity to cure, which was required to do under the lease, and then drew on the letter of credit.
The sequence of events is that Mankel filed under 128, and then a couple of days later was January 1st, and the payment for rent had not been paid. Is that correct?
Correct. And when there's not a payment of rent, then they had to provide a 10-day window or opportunity to cure that default. And Mankel did not do that. And under the letter of credit, when they presented that letter of credit to M&I, they were required to say that pursuant to the terms of the lease, they were drawing on the letter of credit. In other words, if there was a default under the lease, they could draw on the letter of credit. What they can't do is simply draw on the letter of credit at all unless there's a default under the lease. About a year went by, and in that time, Ed Mankel was sold. It was sold to a third party, and the bank got paid in full because the bank had a security interest in the assets.
Let me just, again, for the sequence of events, so the rent wasn't paid on January 1. I thought by the end of that January there had already been an agreement entered in with EBSCO, and that then the receiver no longer occupied the premises. EBSCO did, and on April 1, there was a taking over of the lease by EBSCO. Are those dates correct or incorrect?
They are correct. There wasn't a taking over a lease. A new lease was entered.
I'm sorry.
Right.
Yeah,
I misspoke.
They entered into a lease with Stanton, 700 Stanton. And they
Correct.
Had purchased the assets as a going concern from the receiver.
Correct. And the lease was at a lower rent because, obviously, with a sale-leaseback, you recoup your investment by having a higher lease, market conditions change, and so EBSCO was unable and unwilling to pay the full amount of rent that Ed Mankel had been paying. And so they were paying a lower rent. So by the time this matter, a year later, the receiver sued, and by the time this was heard on summary judgment, 700 Stanton had actually suffered about $600,000 in actual damages, because there's no question that it mitigated its damages by entering into a new lease with EBSCO. In addition, because the tenant didn't want the whole property, they found another tenant to take over another portion of the property. So they went out, found two tenants, but the lease payments were less than what Ann Mackel had promised to pay, so that they were incurring significant damages. Plus, there were some real estate taxes that weren't paid and various insurance and other expenses that normally would have been paid by the tenant that weren't paid.
What's the date that they drew down both letters of credit? Then, if I use January 1 as the date that the rent was due, what was the date that they drew down?
It was probably January 15th or 20th, in that range. And one of the issues that have been raised is the issue of, well, they were only past due rent of 1 month at that point. But under Wisconsin law, what happens is that once the landlord, you know, the landlord did not terminate the lease, and the receiver has argued that it did not terminate the lease. The lease stays in effect. The landlord, under Wisconsin law, has obligations to mitigate its damages. It has to go find out another tenant. And then whatever money it has, it holds in trust for the tenant, so that the pool of money goes against the damages that the tenant is incurring, meaning Ed Mankel.
Did your client do that in reliance on the provision of the lease at page 68? Or did it do so in reliance of the appendix, page 68, where it says, and apply the proceeds in whatever manner landlord deems appropriate. I wonder, when I read that, I'll give you a minute, obviously.
What they did is because they were in default, they drew on the letter of credit.
Yeah.
And what they did is they did not terminate the lease, and then they're going to, in essence, consider the security.
Do you see the section I'm referring to, the line? Just so everybody else knows what I'm talking about, too. Page 68, it is approximately, I don't want to count, the 20th line down. So on the left, it says the line starts credit with a capital C, credit and apply the proceeds. And then the phrase that jumps out at me is, in whatever manner landlord deems appropriate. And when I saw that, I wondered to myself, is that what the landlord relied upon when it took the full $800,000, including the security deposit?
So I think what it relied on, in addition to that, is a little further down. It says, if tenant fails to comply with any or all of its rental obligations hereunder, or in the event that any guarantor default, replacement default, or termination default occurs, landlord, its lender or agent, may, without notice to tenant, draw on the letters of credit, imply the proceeds in whatever manner landlord deems appropriate, in addition to other remedies available to landlord.
Well, so that's the section that I read.
Right. And that's, I'm sorry, I didn't understand that. But yes. And then further below, basically, it also, obviously that section is subject to the general law in Wisconsin that it also has to mitigate its damages.
I guess I'm just trying to make sure that I understand that that's the specific or particular provision that the landlord was relying on. Nothing in any of the chapters or statutes, but that was it, I think.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
I had another question about the lease, because as I read the lease, the landlord had the right to terminate the occupancy but not terminate the lease, and that's under Section 22.2. And there's also in there an escalation provision so that the full amounts of the lease become due when the landlord exercises that. And I'm wondering how you see that provision playing into the argument opposing counsel makes that when you drew down on the letter of credit, you didn't have that amount of money that was owed. And so I wonder if you can comment on that for me.
Right. There is a distinction under Wisconsin law between terminating the lease and then you basically are subject to the limitation of damages at the time of the termination of the lease. And then there is a body of law that says if you go in and re-let it on the tenant's behalf and you don't terminate the lease, which is what 700 Stanton did, then you are, in effect, entitled to future damages. You have to either discount them back to present value, or you have to mitigate your damages, or you basically just wait and hold that money on behalf of the tenant until until your damages have exceeded that, which is what happened here a couple years later.
Okay, well, that's what I was wondering about, because it's discounted at 6%. So if you accelerate all the monies that's due under the lease, on the day you draw down on the letter of credit, you could take the full value of the lease discounted at 6% per year and determine that amount. And what I was wondering is that what you did, or did you have money that the landlord didn't exercise a personal right to at the time of the drawdown of the letters of credit?
No, I believe the landlord looked to that, discounted it back. That's what its damages are. It obviously can't get, I mean, it has to discount it back to present value. It knew that it was going to have significant damages in excess of that, and that's what it did. And then in addition to that, it applied that $750 against its damages. And then by the time of the trial, of course, it had suffered actual damages in excess of that as well.
You think you can do both? Discount it? I mean, accelerate the lease, discount it and get a number? And then you think you can make that number bigger later on?
No, I don't think so. I think what happens is you can discount it back, but the discounted amount over a 15-year period is well in excess of anything we're talking about.
Right.
You can't get double damages if that's what you're asking.
Yeah, and I guess I'm trying to see what kind of an election the landlord made, because when I read that and I saw how things were re-letted, and there was an argument about whether the lease was terminated, and the landlord's position is we never terminated the lease, we terminated the occupancy.
Right, right, exactly.
Right. Just so I understand. Thank you.
Counsel, as I understood the response in the petition for review, there was some question by your opposing counsel as to whether or not you were entitled to draw all the monies at the time that you did. But that question wasn't, I didn't see squarely presented in this review. It was only at this stage. What are the issues that we are to address today?
The issues we are here in front of the court on are whether or not Chapter 128.17 creates a new cause of action with, quote, diminishment of the estate. Because the trial court said, I don't have to decide these issues. And we have never argued that if there are legitimate concerns, that if there's a legitimate cause of action for improper draw on the letter of credit, that Ed Mankel can't allege that or sue us for that. But what they've said is the letter of credit is an independent obligation on behalf of M&I. Once M&I paid us, meaning 700 Stanton, and then realized on its collateral after the receivership was filed, that realization of its collateral diminished the estate, and therefore we can go back, not against M&I, but from 700 Stanton based on 128.17.
Let me be more pointed. Are the issues that we have before us today set forth in page 1 of your brief, and there are two issues that are set forth. Are those the issues we have before us today?
Those are the two issues that this court has asked, or that's what we filed our petition for review on.
And that's what we are to address here today. Or is there something else? I mean, what I'm trying to do is clarify. I prepared this case as though these were the issues because this is what we took the case on and because this is what your brief says. And it says the first issue is a beneficiary of a letter of credit from a bank which holds a general business security agreement and all of the debtor's property, a secured creditor, and therefore outside the purview of 128. So I said, okay, the first issue is whether or not under those circumstances here today it's a secured creditor. And then issue number two, alternatively, does it violate the independence principle in WISSTAT 45.103 and common law governing letters of credit to allow an action against the beneficiary of a letter of credit arising out of the issuing bank's enforcement of its security interest against the debtor's estate?
And I guess I should clarify, I apologize, but one of the related issues is whether 128.17.2 creates this independent cause of action for diminishment of the estate. And that is sort of tied into the second thing, is what is this independent principle, and is landlords, and especially in light of the response in the brief of Ed Mankel, whether or not 128.17 provides a independent cause of action or somehow caps landlord damages.
Now, did the Court of Appeals address that issue? Didn't the Court of Appeals address the two issues? Number one, are you a secured creditor? If you're a secured creditor, the Court of Appeals said, therefore, we need not decide what comes within or outside the scope of 128. Number two, we address the issue of independence principle and whether there's a violation. That's what I think the Court of Appeals did.
But the Court of Appeals also went further and said, because of this independence principle argument, that there was this diminishment of the estate, and therefore. So it did address the argument.
If you don't mind, let's start with the first issue, secured creditor. Is a beneficiary of a letter of credit from a bank which holds a general business security agreement on all of the debtor's property of secured creditor.
Okay. And that definition of what a secured creditor is defined in Chapter 128. There's a specific definition. Now, it may be a little bit different than normally what you would think a secured creditor is, say, on Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code. And the specific language of 128 provides that a secured creditor, is a creditor who has a legal or equitable security for his or her debt upon any property of the insolvent debtor of a nature to be liquidated and distributed in liquidation proceedings, or a creditor to whom is owed a debt for such security is possessed by some endorser, surety, or other person secondarily liable. Chapter 128, and that's in section 128.25, paren 1e. This definition is taken from the Bankruptcy Act of 1898. And what that was designed to do is to prevent secured creditors from being able to provide, to file a proof of claim to share in what other exempt assets the receiver might have. And so they didn't want a secured creditor to be able to file a proof of claim. And in addition, if you had a surety or a guarantor or someone else who was had to step up to the plate and pay the debt, but they had a security interest in the debtor's asset, they didn't want you being able to file a proof of claim in the receivership either. You were supposed to look to your guarantor or somebody else for payment first, and then if they were a secured creditor, they looked to their secured collateral. It was a way to design to limit the number of claims that could be filed in the receivership estate. And the receiver has two primary arguments why a letter of credit is not a holder, the bank in this case, is not secondarily liable. Their first argument is, well, M&I has an independent obligation to pay. You must pay.
Let me, again, if I may, just for clarification, you're not relying on the definition of the secured creditor in 128.25 on the first part of the definition, are you? It seems to me you're relying on the or a creditor to whom is owed a debt.
Correct. As to the security deposit, there's an open question because I think under this language we may have an equitable security for the debt on the property of the debtor. But as far as the letters of credit, no, we're relying on the second part of the definition. So the issue is here whether or not M&I is secondarily liable under this definition. And if you look to the nature of a surety has an independent obligation to pay. You look to the nature of a guarantee of payment, not collection, they have an independent obligation to pay. A letter of credit, meaning M&I, also has an independent obligation to pay. But like everything else, that's only triggered if we present a letter of the letter to the bank saying under the lease, we have a right to look to this letter of credit. It's the same as with a guarantor or a surety. Their liability springs into being, their independent obligation springs into being when there's a triggering event.
But isn't there a problem with doing that, Counselor? Because a guarantor has the same defenses as the debtor, but the payor on a letter of credit does not have those defenses. He has absolute right to pay without defense, right?
No, actually, there are some limited defenses for the payor, M&I.
Well,
but
if it's fraud or something like that. The bank cannot raise the defenses that a guarantor could raise if the guarantor were asked to make payment. The guarantor can raise any defense the debtor could raise, right?
Well, first,
that right? Okay.
Well, the reason why I say no is because you're right, he has to pay first, but then he's subrogated under 405 to all the rights of ADMACO or to the debtor. So if the bank pays and decides that it was an improper draw on the letter of credit, they step in the shoes of ADMACO and they can bring a claim against 700 Stanton. So it is true that they have to pay first and sue later, but they do step in the shoes of the debtor, so they do have the debtor's rights under Chapter 405.
But other folks that provide security, like a guarantor, can raise those defenses prior to payment, right?
Not necessarily, because the way the law is now with guarantors is that they can waive all sorts of defenses. And in fact, they do routinely. The WBA forms say we don't have to look to the collateral. We can look to you first. If we misuse the collateral, we dispose of it, doesn't matter. You're still obligated.
Well, it depends on if it's a guarantee of payment or a secondary guarantee, correct?
Not necessarily, because a guarantee of payment is we'll pay first, regardless.
Right.
If it's a guarantee of collection, then there may be some additional defenses, but not necessarily. It depends on the contract, the document.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So under this definition...
Let me interrupt for a minute. You're, according to your answer to Justice Bradley, relying on the language in Chapter 128 that the creditor who is owed a debt is a secured creditor. How does that fit with the argument that there wasn't any significant debt due because you are claiming, apparently, on behalf of your client, rent that had not yet come due? How do you respond to that?
Easy. I'm sorry. I apologize.
I'm not so sure it's that easy. Go ahead.
The response?
Right. Let me take that back. I think there's two reasons that I think we can respond to that. First, again, the lease allowed us to accelerate the rent and discount it back to present value. The second is under Chapter 128.17.2, which is the section that talks about capping landlord's damages to past due rent and actual damages, only deals with distributions through the debtor's estate. Here, we received the payment from M&I. It was not a distribution through the debtor's estate. There's nothing in Chapter 128 that caps a landlord's ability to go after, say, a third-party guarantor or another avenue for payment. That section, if you read it in context with the other sections, provide that unsecured creditors, file proof of claim, then the receiver takes those assets, distributes them in an order of priority, and landlords in the receivership estate are limited. But Chapter 128 doesn't have any mechanism for terminating the lease and cutting off future damages. The lease would flow through like it did under the old Bankruptcy Act. The only thing the landlord couldn't get was money from the receivership estate, but the lease didn't go through, which is the primary difference between that and the bankruptcy code where they rely on that says, oh, it caps your damages for future rent. I see my time is up.
You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the Court, my name is Kevin Keeler. I'm here representing Admanco, Inc. by the receiver Michael S. Polsky. I think the central issue in this case underlying the issues that are presented here is whether a landlord can employ the device of a letter of credit in order to avoid the cap on a landlord's claim under Section 128.17 sub 2. Trial court said no, Court of Appeals said no. And the federal courts applying a similar cap on landlord claims under the bankruptcy code also said no.
Counselor, how do you address the argument that's made that this Chapter 128 does not follow the current bankruptcy code and therefore cases and that argument just don't apply here?
Well, Your Honor, I think that there are a lot of similar provisions, as we pointed out in our brief, between Chapter 128 and the bankruptcy code, specifically with regard to liens and things of that nature.
Right, but there's a big difference when the bankruptcy code was changed in regard to how that code then treated landlords' claims. How do you address that with regard to 128, which wasn't changed?
Well, I think you're referring to the change that was initially made, I think, back in 1934 under the Federal Bankruptcy Act that actually recognized a limited claim that a landlord could have for future rent in a bankruptcy case, but it was capped. It was a compromise that was made because the case law up to that point held that a landlord did not have a claim for future rent, did not have a provable claim in a bankruptcy situation. That did not make its way into Chapter 128.
Right.
But Chapter 128 does specifically deal with a landlord's claim. Prior to the revision of Chapter 128 in 1937, there was no language like that in the statute. As a matter of fact, we got a copy of the legislative file, and it's a kind of a poor microfiche copy of the page where it was actually handwritten in the language we're talking about today. But I think the concept is the same. For whatever reason, the Wisconsin legislature decided we're not going to give a similar kind of limited claim to a landlord. We prefer to give the claim permit the landlord to have a claim as we've defined it in Section 128.17 sub 2. So the difference is really between the two different regimes. And I think it's a legislative question as to whether maybe that should be changed. Maybe it should be brought more up to date, but it hasn't been. But that's kind of the underlying impetus of this case, and that is whether you can use a letter of credit to, in a sense, get more assets out of the bankruptcy estate indirectly, not directly, but indirectly through the issuing bank in payment of a claim that otherwise is limited.
Counselor, if we wanted to have business go on throughout the state of Wisconsin, and that was what the legislature was trying to do here, how, if the letter of credit won't work to secure a sale leaseback like we have here, if it won't work to protect the creditor, how does the creditor get protected, because they aren't going to do these deals if they can't be protected? So if the letter of credit can be voided out by the acts of a receiver, then how does the creditor get protection?
Well, I think one point is that statute's been on the books for over 70 years. And as far as I know, it hasn't really held things up too much. But there are other ways to go about it. I think the Court of Appeals decision was very clear in what it decided. And I think any attorney advising a landlord or potential landlord tenant can say, well, you know, if this thing goes into receivership, we're not going to be able to acquire assets of the estate to pay your claim for future rent to the extent you might have one. So you better secure yourself by assets outside of the estate.
Okay, so, and that's the other argument of opposing counsel, is that the proceeds of the letter of credit are not property of the estate and, in fact, occur outside of the estate. But your argument is to the contrary. You are saying that they are, in fact, assets of the estate because you collapse them with M&I's realization of their collateral, right?
That's about it. I think the bankruptcy cases that we've cited in the brief kind of make it clear. They say, on the one hand, the proceeds of the letter of credit are not assets of the estate, but that's kind of a red herring. The collateral that was pledged for the letter of credit is an asset of the estate. And so you can't do or shouldn't be permitted to do indirectly what you couldn't do directly.
Well, and that just goes back to my basic question as I was thinking about this case, just from a common sense standpoint. How would anyone ever want to buy a building, give someone $2.8 million, take a 15-year lease back with no security? So now they've given up $2.8 million. They can't rely on the lease, and they can't rely on a letter of credit to secure what they thought was a debt they wanted to secure. So what can they do?
Well, one thing we need to keep in mind is that this was not a loan from Stanton to Edmankel.
No, it's just part of a business deal.
Right.
I do understand.
They bought
that.
The building, so they sure. owned the building, mm-hmm. And then they entered the 15-year lease. Mm-hmm. I think letters of credit are still valuable because in many cases you have a claim for past due rent. Mm-hmm. By the time the debtor hits a receivership situation or bankruptcy, you may be months behind. Mm-hmm. If you've got a letter of credit that covers that, you're paid in full. That's within the context of the cap. You're permitted that. If you can prove other sorts of damages, there's another section of 128.17.2, which is for certain rejection damages. The trial court and the Court of Appeals held that wasn't
They said the lease
here.
Wasn't rejected.
Right. So you have that. You'd be protected fully there for your under a letter of credit. And then, as I said before, if you have a guarantor who has assets and can pledge those assets to the bank for an issuance of a letter of credit, as happened here.
Well, here they're trying to get part of the $100,000+ that was part of the guarantor. The receiver is trying to take that out of Stanton as well.
Well, I guess it's the perspective you look at it from. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can look at it from that perspective and say, gee, we hate to have to pay that $100,000 back. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it did deplete the estate by that amount, and the other creditors are shorted. Or you can say, look, we got to keep $260,000 because the receiver went out in his own initiative, maybe in a mitigation of damages, and got those assets back from the Bumbies, who were the guarantors. So that kind of proves my point. No one's challenging their right to that $200,000+, whether or not the lease entitled them to that when they drew on the letter of credit. Now, maybe the guarantors might if they thought it was important, but they haven't so far.
Thank you.
Your opposing counsel spoke of 128.17 as referencing the debtor's estate, and your position on page 34 of your brief is that only subsection 1 applies to the debtor's estate. Are you saying that opposing counsel misrepresented the meaning of the statute, or is it up in the air?
I don't think they misrepresented the meaning of the statute. We may have a disagreement as to what the import is. But I think opposing counsel was trying to make the argument that Section 128.17 only deals with the distribution of the general assets of the estate, and therefore has nothing to say about secured creditors. And so therefore, I think, you know, the primary rationale for the argument that we have today about whether or not they're a secured creditor is that opposing counsel believes that if they're a secured creditor, they can kind of sail through the Chapter 128 unaffected. And as we argue in our brief, number one, we don't think they're a secured creditor under that definition under Section 128.25. Because a letter of credit issuer is not an endorser or surety or other party secondarily liable. But this whole secured creditor argument, I think, is a bit of a red herring itself. Because let's take the example if the landlord, instead of getting a letter of credit, just had an outright lien on the assets.
Had an outright what, lien, did you say?
Yes. Let's say they had an outright lien on the assets of the estate rather than using the device of a letter of credit. Well, would that mean that they could just take their collateral for the full amount regardless of the Section 128.17(2) cap?
Well, if they're a secured creditor, maybe. Hmm?
Well, we would argue that they couldn't. Mm-hmm. And that's where we come into the interesting case that was authored by Judge Posner in the Seventh Circuit, the Unisys Finance case. It was kind of a similar situation. You had an equipment lessor who leased computer equipment to a bank. The bank went into a receivership, and now the federal receivership law takes effect. And under the federal receivership law, it said that a lessor has zero claim for future rent. And that was the only claim the lessor had because they had paid the bank had paid up to the date of the receivership. And the court said, if you don't have a claim, you don't have a lien. So, I mean, if you have a mortgage on your house, for example, it doesn't mean the bank owns the house. The bank only has a lien on your house for the amount that's owed. And so the question here is, does 128.17 determine the amount owed, the amount of the claim that can be paid out of the assets of the estate? And I think that section needs to be looked at as a limitation of the liability of estate assets to pay a landlord claim.
Counsel, in looking at the Court of Appeals brief, and you discussed that, of course, at the very outset in your brief, and when I said Court of Appeals brief, I meant Court of Appeals opinion, is there anything that you would add to or detract from, subtract from that opinion?
Well, I think there were a couple of issues the Court of Appeals didn't feel it needed to address. For example, with regard to the secured creditor issue.
Well, they addressed the secured creditor issue, as you say on page 4 of your brief. The Court of Appeals affirmed the circuit court holding that Stanton was not a secured creditor. Having found that Stanton was not a secured creditor, the Court of Appeals did not address Stanton's argument that, as a secured creditor, its claim would fall outside of the receivership proceeding. Right. Was the Court of Appeals in error not deciding that second part?
No, I think it didn't have to. It found that they weren't a secured creditor. And my reading of that, I think it's in a footnote, is that if they had found they were a secured creditor, that wouldn't have ended the analysis. then they'd have to go the next step.
That's right.
Say, does that make a difference?
That's right. But having found them to not be a secured creditor, they said they need not answer the question of whether or not, as a secured creditor, its claim would fall outside 128.
Correct.
Do you disagree? Is there anything you would add to or subtract from the Court of Appeals opinion?
I thought the opinion was pretty thorough.
I mean, you won. You liked it. But
yes.
It sounds to me like you're wanting to add a little bit to it.
Well, I think we because of the fact that these issues are being looked at again, we felt it important in our brief this time around to go further into the question as to whether it makes a difference if you're a secured creditor or not a secured creditor if you're a landlord. And I think that's an important issue, and I think it's fairly clear that it shouldn't make a difference. Because either way, the estate, whether it's because there's a lien or because there's not a lien, is ending up paying more than what the legislature intended it to pay with respect to future rent. Now, future rent is rent accruing, you know, after the receivership has been filed. So it comes out of the pockets of other creditors at that point. The business is no longer operating, doesn't generate profits that it can use to pay the rent at that point. You've just got basically a corpse, and the question is, you know, are you going to allow a landlord claim? And in this case, by the way, Stanton filed a claim for $6 million for future rent. Now, that's a huge claim. If that claim were allowed in the full amount, it would dilute all the other claims tremendously, and the other creditors would walk away with very little, while the landlord has the building back, has the opportunity to re-rent to other creditors, I mean to other tenants, and is has been paid up to the point of the receivership proceeding.
Counselor, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about Section 405.103 sub 4, please.
Okay.
And the argument that opposing counsel makes about the independence of a letter of credit. And I guess my concern is this. The statute to which I referred says that a letter of credit is independent of, and I'll skip some words, but an arrangement between the issuer and the applicant. Now, the issuer here is M&I. The applicant is the debtor. And what I believe occurred here is that in order to reach these proceeds, which are, you admit, not property of the state to begin with, you have to collapse that arrangement between the debtor and the issuer. How do you do that with subsection 4 saying the letter of credit is to be on an independent basis, independent specifically of that arrangement?
I do that by looking at the three contracts as separate contracts. You've got the contract between the applicant and the issuer, which basically says if the issuer pays the letter of credit, the applicant will reimburse it. And you've got the separate contract between the issuer and the beneficiary, which says if you present the conforming documents, and we really don't care if there's an actual breach, by the way, if you give us documents that conform to the letter, we're obligated under the statute and the agreement to pay you.
Right.
That's a separate one. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the contract and legal relationship between the applicant and the beneficiary.
Right.
Now, when the letter of credit has been paid, when Stanton received that $750,000, the independent contract between Stanton as beneficiary and M&I Bank was done, was satisfied. M&I Bank did what it was supposed to do under that contract, and we're fine. When Stanton paid the assets of the estate to M&I Bank to reimburse it, that took care of that independent relationship. So, but whether Stanton is entitled to keep the funds based on receivership law and the effect that the draw of the letter of credit had on the receivership estate, that's a separate issue, and I don't think that that affects the independence principle at all. In other words, the independence principle was satisfied when those two contracts were satisfied.
Yeah. But you are connecting the contracts. I mean, you're connecting the arrangement. They don't even say contract. They say arrangement out of which the letter of credit arises. So you're really connecting the payment of the letter of credit with the security interest that's between M&I and the debtor, right? Because if M&I didn't exercise on its security, you wouldn't be trying to get at the proceeds from the letter of credit, right?
Right.
Okay, so you got to collapse them or you don't get at that proceeds from the letter of credit, and I don't quite see how you can do that with the statute.
Well, the connection, by way of referencing the federal courts that have looked at this issue, is by looking at the letter of credit as a security deposit. They kind of fold the letter of credit in because it's there to secure the debtor's obligations, I mean the tenant's obligations under the lease, in the same way that the cash security deposit is there.
Well, the cash security deposit came from the debtor. I don't have any problems with your arguments about that at all.
But in a sense, the letter of credit did too, because the letter of credit would not have been issued but for the fact that it was secured by the assets of the estate. The bank's not going to issue a letter of credit unless it's sure that it's adequately collateralized. So it's an indirect way to get at the assets of the estate. It's through the bank, but it's still the end result is the same as if the estate simply paid the money directly.
Well, you know, you could have someone that owned this company that was Howard Hughes, God rest his soul, and have enough money that he didn't need to worry about collateralizing anything with the property of the debtor and still have taken this company into a Chapter 128 proceeding, and there wouldn't be a lien against the property of the estate. Howard Hughes would just sign his name and the bank would issue the letter of credit. So you really have to have the two tied together or you can't get to the property of the debtor, can you?
Well, that's correct. It's kind of the entire problem with the device. In other words, when it's secured by the assets of the estate, that's what results in the diminution of the estate.
Right, but you know, Chapter 405.103 talks about letters of credit. It doesn't just talk about letters of credit that happen to get involved in a Chapter 128 proceeding. It has independent principles that operate no matter where the letter of credit is going, doesn't it?
Correct. Yes.
Thank you.
Of what import is, and I'm looking at the appendix, page 67, 4.3 entitled Security Deposit. Of what import is it that in that section, on that page, under the heading of Security Deposit, it indicates that letters of credit shall at all times constitute security to and for the benefit of landlords for the timely and complete performance by tenant of its rental obligations, and it continues on. Is it part of your argument that under the terms of this lease, letters of credit are security deposit?
Yes. It's brought in under the heading security deposit. It's being used to secure the obligations of the tenant, and then when the lease is expired, then the letters of credit would no longer be necessary.
Explain again of what import it is that letters of credit are the security deposit. I know this gets you into the how you can, if you will, Justice Rogensack used the word collapse, but how you can bring the two together. But explain that again.
Well, contrary to what counsel said, we really didn't just make this theory up. We went and did a tremendous amount of research, and one of the cases that's cited often in the bankruptcy context is the Olden versus Taunton Realty, 1944 case. It was under the bankruptcy code after it had been modified to include a landlord claim, and the court in that case did a careful analysis and held that the security deposit cut against the capped claim of the landlord. And the cases that have kind of followed the Olden concept or the Olden rationale in the letter of credit context have held that a letter of credit serves the same function as a security deposit. And if a security deposit, to the extent it might exceed the amount of the landlord's allowed claim, would need to be returned, in the same fashion, a letter of credit that's serving that same function to the extent it affects the assets of the estate and results in a depletion of the estate assets over and above what the landlord is entitled to receive from those assets, then in like manner, the proceeds need to be returned to replenish the estate for that depletion. So that's, I think, where the tie comes in there. Now, I wanted to say a few words about the idea about if Stanton is a secured creditor, do these other sections of Chapter 128 basically say they get to keep all of the funds, even though they exceed the estate? And I think we need to look at really what is the purpose of Section 128.25 and 128.15.2, which are the sections that are being referred to. Section 128.25 is the Uniform Act governing secured creditors' dividends and liquidation proceedings that was adopted, I think, in the early 1940s. We did research on that act, and it's very difficult to find a case under it. It's been around a long time, but it appears, if you look at the annotated, the uniform laws annotated, what was the purpose? The purpose was to figure out a way to value collateral. If a creditor is holding collateral, there were different rules in different states as to whether the creditor would have to account for the value of that collateral and then file a claim in a receivership proceeding for the difference, or whether the creditor could simply just file a claim for the entire amount and disregard the value of the collateral. And you had situations, apparently, where creditors weren't even disclosing that they had collateral, and they file their claim and get kind of double paid. And you can see that right in Section 128.25 sub 2 says you got to disclose your collateral. That was the purpose of that section. Similarly, 128.15.2 kind of tracks that same thing. It says if a secured creditor is going to file an unsecured claim in the case, you've got to take account of the value of the collateral. That's what those statutes are addressing. They're not addressing how you determine how much you owe the secured creditor. That's an entirely separate issue. Now, under Wisconsin brick and block, a secured creditor cannot have its collateral taken from them. Well, what does that mean? It simply means that if you've got a mortgage on property that's in a receivership, the court can't simply sell it and disregard your mortgage. You have to somehow participate in the receivership proceeding and consent to that sale free and clear of your mortgage. But it doesn't have anything to do with how much you're actually owed and how much your mortgage actually secures. So I think, you know, we can't read too much into those sections of the statute.
Counselor, you know, if I buy your argument, well, I mean, I don't, when all of this came into being, the receiver had already made arrangements, had sold property, had compromised the obligation of the Bumbleys, and at none of those points was Stanton allowed to participate. Doesn't that strike you as kind of being an uneven playing field? Where, you know, if you were in federal bankruptcy court, you'd have preferences. You could draw back in payments that were made prior to the filing of the bankruptcy, so you don't let one person have their obligation excused for less or receive a payment for more. And none of those rules are present in 128, and they weren't really operative here. So doesn't that seem kind of uneven to you that in this proceeding, Stanton simply doesn't have a right to participate until many decisions are made, yet now you want to draw in federal bankruptcy law in regard to the cap on landlords' rights to receive part of the payout? I have a hard time seeing how you fit all those together in a way that's fair to everybody that's involved.
Well, everything the receiver does, for example, the actual sale of the assets is put on notice to creditors. Creditors can object. The settlement with the Bumbies was put on notice to creditors, and the court had to approve that settlement.
So how would they object? How would Stanton have objected to the workout that was done with the Bumbies?
Could file an objection with the court and showed up for the hearing indicated why it thought the settlement was unfair.
I may be mistaken. I had thought that occurred before the receivership began.
No, that occurred after the receivership.
Okay.
Right. I think that was sometime in 2006, actually, when the receiver entered that, that settlement.
Thank you.
A couple of things that I wanted to just mention. Which I can't read my handwriting on, unfortunately, but I'll have to go on to the next point.
You have to take up typing like I do.
Yes. I think it's important to not overstate the effect of the Court of Appeals decision. There's a lot of language in the briefs about the sky is going to fall with this thing, and letters of credit can't be used anymore, and smaller tenants, non-creditworthy tenants, will not be able to get leases because they won't be able to get letters of credit. I think this is what we've got here really is just a basic receivership question. Who's entitled to assets when a company goes into receivership? And as a practical matter, I do not think letters of credit are used that often, particularly in regard to smaller tenants. We represent several landlords with retail centers in three states. We probably negotiated 100 leases, if not more. I've never come across a letter of credit in that kind of a context. They may be important in a large transaction like the present one, where there was a sale and a leaseback, and the landlord wanted to get as much protection as it did. And it got that protection. It got paid a $750,000 on, I think it was January 10th, 2005. It still has that money, even though we don't believe it's entitled to keep it all. But that's what the purpose of that, it satisfied the purpose of a letter of credit, which is pay now, argue later.
No, the purpose of the letter of credit, counselor, is to prevent a financial loss. And if you prevail here, they will suffer a financial loss. So the purpose of the letter of credit will only operate if you lose here. If you win here, the letter of credit really has given them nothing. A lot of attorney's fees probably for counsel, but.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I respectfully disagree. I think that it's important that the state law be harmonized with the bankruptcy law as well, so that counseling landlords, counseling tenants, you know, you don't have to say, well, this is what happens in the state court, and this is what happens in bankruptcy court, and we have to do something different, because you don't know whether they're going to be ending up in receivership or bankruptcy if things go wrong.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you that you have to try to work out how these work out both. My disagreement was just your statement that the letter of credit served its purpose, but really the purpose is to prevent financial loss. And it may be that it will if you lose here, and if you win here, I think that it won't have served the purpose, at least that the parties thought they were getting from it when they took it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I see that my time is up.
If I may, you were quoting from some case or treatise when you just said that phrase, pay now and... do you remember what you were quoting from, or do you think you were original?
No.
He's always original.
That's the type of phrase you might hear from the Seventh Circuit, and I think it is one of the cases cited from the Seventh Circuit.
Thank you, counsel.
I think we both agree that the Olden case is important. And what's interesting about the Olden case, it does a really good job of explaining the old law, the Bankruptcy Act of 1898, which Chapter 128 is modeled, where landlords have no claim for future damages, but their lease survives. There's no mechanism for rejecting it. And under the old Bankruptcy Act, landlords could look to third-party guarantors for payment. They could do whatever they could do. They just couldn't get money through the receivership estate. Then the cap came in where the courts or the under the code where the government, or excuse me, the code says you can get future damages, landlords, because it's really unfair to you, especially during the Depression. This cap came in the Depression. So we'll let you have future damages, but we're going to cap it to 1 year or 15% of the remaining term, whichever is greater. And so that's a federal statute. It preempts state law. So the federal statute says these are what your actual damages are, landlord, and this is what you're capped. If we had been in bankruptcy, we would have been fine. The same way with the receivership statute that they were citing. The receivership statute, for whatever reason, says you don't get any future damages, so therefore your damages are limited. It does away with your state court rights. Well, we're not in federal court. We're not under a federal statute. We're in a state court proceeding, and Chapter 128.17 sub 2 doesn't create a cause of action that doesn't exist. There are explicit causes of action in Chapter 128, but nowhere does it say that there's a right to go after a landlord indirectly for something that's outside the landlord's control. For instance, the Bumby's letter of credit, that's a third-party letter of credit. They had Stanton had no way to know that the Bumbies were going to pledge Ed Mankel's assets to cover their personal letter of credit. And if I understand the receiver's position, it doesn't matter because even if you are a secured credit or unsecured, you're still capped. Well, nothing in 128.17.2 says we're going to cap damages outside of what the distribution is during the debtor's estate. And remember, the debtor's estate comes into being at the time of the receivership. At that time, they had no right to these letters of credit proceeds. So M&I's actions, sort of according to their theory, indirectly triggered it. What happened if a letter of credit holder draws on a letter of credit before the receivership? And then M&I again looks to its collateral, which is fine. That's what it should have been doing. Then all of a sudden, boom, you're back into the situation where somehow you diminish the estate and you've got to pay it back in. It doesn't make sense. 128.17 says the order of distribution is such. Then it says debts to become due as well. Debts due may be proved, meaning you can file a proof of claim. And then it goes on to say the court may order a dividend to be paid. So that's what it's dealing with. It's distributions through the bankruptcy or the receivership
estate. So I want to look at sub 2 then.
Mm-hmm.
And that says, and the Olden case. In fact, it was when I was preparing for this, the Courts of Appeals treatment of the Olden case in paragraphs 11, 12, and 13 of its opinion that made me think, aren't you in the wrong wing of the state capitol? In the Court of Appeals discussion of the Olden case says, hey, all the parties agree that that you can't get future, the parties agree that the Wisconsin provisions, that is 128.17.2, were not amended to allow limited future damages, but rather retain the original pre-1934 limitation to past due rent. And someplace they have a footnote that says, you know, this might be tough, but that's the way the legislature wrote it, and they haven't changed it. The feds changed it in 1934, but we went with the 1989 in saying that a claim shall be limited to past due rent or to any actual damages, etc. So what about that? Why, aren't you in the wrong wing of the capitol?
If I was here as an unsecured landlord saying this is unfair because I've got a potential million-dollar claim and these other unsecured creditors have smaller claims and I'm getting limited to past due rent, yes, then I am in the wrong.
That's why your argument really starts with, but you are a secured creditor.
Well, I'm also a creditor who got paid by a third party. I'm not in the order of distribution out of the debtor's estate. Anything that happens prior to the receivership, whether you pledge a letter of credit or you give a guarantee or you give a security interest to a secured creditor, that doesn't affect the order of distribution. So whether I'm a secured creditor or not, as long as I'm not having my hand out to the receiver saying, I want any assets you collect that are unsecured, I want more than what 128.17 gives me, then I think that I don't, that this statute doesn't provide something that they're trying to argue for. I'm looking to other assets for payment as a landlord. If I was an unsecured creditor, I didn't have a letter of credit, yes, then I would be limited. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. Some very interesting arguments. The court will reconvene at 5 to 3. That gives you time. 5 to 3. What time do you want?
After. About 10 after.
10 after 3.
Right.
Absolutely. I wish I had said that first, Justice.
But as long as you said it second, it works.
And after 3, it shall be. We are in recess. Thank you.